For November 12th, Robert Reich. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So before I bring in our more than perfect guest, my increasingly wonderful colleague Joshua Fouts, Executive Director of Bioneers, let me weave a little bit of context. So I will be embarking on my barking birthday tour next week. October 15th, I will again be at Open Secret Bookstore at 7 p.m. with Amakayla Gaston. It's our green room for Bioneers. And again, you can get tickets to the Open Secret Bookstore event at 415-457-4191. And then on to Bioneers on Friday, October 16th at 9:10 p.m., but get there a little earlier. It's included in the price for those who sign up for the whole Bioneers conferring, but also a very, very, very inexpensive price at the door. So you can just show up at the exhibit hall at the Marin Civic Center on Friday, October 16th. The themes that we'll be weaving, really all of us, wherever we are and whatever event we're going to, the Scheherazade is the Earth, inaugurating Trickster's guiding cultural meta-story. We say Scheherazade is the quintessential compassionate trickster redeemer, animating the power of the woman storyteller, regardless of our extremely temporary age, race, and gender assignment, to liberate all women, the land, and even the tyrant who has hardened his heart. She guides us all to wed the earth. In this night, and now, we cahoot with the mythological ancestors for a rousing evening of astro-mytho-political storytelling, animating, magnetizing, and spiraling forth into the memosphere, the irresistible, all-inclusive invitation to a renaissance of reverent ingenuity rising from the rubble. Rah, 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 rah. Yes, loving alliteration. Can't resist. So, weaving our context now, so much going on. It's dark of the moon. Dark of the moon before a new moon on Monday. Dark of the Moon is traditionally when, you know, all of us, the elder or maven part of all of us, would gather to determine the course of culture, which is why we're calling today's show The Art of Directing Cultural Intelligence. It's a highly mutable time right now. It says the protoplasm of reality is especially susceptible to imaginative imprint. The sun's image today is a boat dock wrecked by storms, rebuilding the entire framework of one's enterprise. Woo, yes, after this Mercury retrograde, let's do that. And also rebuilding as a warm-up to rebuilding the world. Right now in the sky, there's a Venus-Moon conjunction. Venus on her Renaissance change of heart, spicy trickster revelatory tour, now has bestowed upon her the mannered language of eloquence she reclaims. So my moon's in Virgo, our wonderful guest, Joshua Fouts' moon in Virgo, and the moon's in Virgo right now. Okay, we're going to come back to that. So it's beautiful. And for those who stay up late or get up early, there's a really fabulous vision to behold before dawn tomorrow. If one gets up before dawn, before the sun rises, one will see Venus and the moon, right there, and Mars and Jupiter all lined up in Virgo, this realm of pragmatic mysticism. And we go, oh, and more fantastic things. So the word that it kind of arose in my mind driving to the studio was pandemonium. Mercury, of course, the great trickster, has been retrograde, and I believe magic is a willingness to cooperate with everything, but it has been really rigorous. Engineering issues and things lost and mysterious things and, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And we go, oh, just kidding, just testing our manners and our, you know, equanimity, and Mercury will go direct tomorrow morning, still in its shadow, of course, but at 10:58 a.m. East Coast time. Then we go, oh, there we go. So, more than perfectly, here we go. I'm welcoming my colleague Joshua Fouts. He is Executive Director of Bioneers. We want to speak of chimps and virtual reality. We will elaborate. Joshua was raised with chimps by parents running a nonprofit dedicated to defending the rights of animals. Yes, he is a social entrepreneur, a communicator for peace between the diversity of cultures, peoples, and living beings on the planet, and more that is incredibly pertinent to everything going on right now. Welcome, Joshua.
Ah, thank you. It's such an honor to be here, Carolyn. I'm a fanboy. I'm an official fanboy, and here I am.
That's very, very charming. So there's so many places we want to go, and I know that you're presiding over many panels at Bioneers, one of which is, well, it's not a panel, but one of the events on Friday is you're interviewing your parents.
It is indeed at 2:45 on Friday, October 16th at Bioneers, the first official day of Bioneers. I will be having the great honor of interviewing on a panel for the first time ever in public my parents, Roger and Debbie Fouts, who spent 40 years working with a family of five chimpanzees who were cross-fostered, that is, raised as deaf human children, immersed in sign language like we were immersed in our first language. And lo, those chimpanzees acquired sign language and used it to both communicate with each other and with humans and passed it on to their offspring.
And the five chimps, did they volunteer?
They did not volunteer, and that's one of the great, I think, tragedies of this research project, and certainly one that I'll be talking with my parents about, because they essentially had a crisis of ethics midway through their career, where they realized that this was a project that in some ways should never have been done, because it unfortunately condemned five sapient non-human primates to a life of imprisonment. And as my dad says, it's not because you can't predict the behavior of chimps, it's because you can't predict the behavior of humans around chimps.
Yeah, and you know, it's, as we're heading into this field, you know, that is dancing so strongly, I hope you don't mind if I pay a little bit of reference to your chart, your astrological chart. Is that okay with you?
Please do.
Oh, I do love it. Because, you know, it's so engaged in now. Your Mercury is at 7 degrees of Pisces. For the first time in 165 years, Neptune dreams, vision, how a culture tells itself its own story through the images that move through collective mind. Is it stationing at 7 Pisces? We go, oh, Joshua, you are so now. And I love the Sabian for that degree, which is a girl or boy with a bugle calling in a new tide of cultural energy. And we are. And part of the dynamic of now that I think you're so engaged in, and that we're, you know, we all are, and let's give voice to it, is Saturn in Sagittarius. Again, yes, we want to create working structures of cooperation among highly diverse cultures and beings and everything, which you've dedicated to. We want to come right back to that. And Saturn squares Neptune, and all squares are really assignments to get illusorily estranged principles to dance together in us and in the world. So knowledge and science with mysticism, compassion, ethics, you know, we want to get that together, you know, so that science is not based on cruelty, right? I mean, so that we can learn things by not tormenting creatures, but by maybe giving them more pleasure.
I love that. I don't know that I could have framed it any more eloquently and articulately than you could, but I have to say that I've struggled having Mercury in Pisces, because it's, I think Einstein had Mercury in Pisces, which was something that I thought was novel, but you do wade in the waters a bit sometimes, and it creates, shall we say, a non-linear way of thinking, but the way that you framed it as being tapped into the zeitgeist is a much more auspicious way of looking at it. So definitely.
You definitely are. As I mentioned backstage, I go, you know, your moon's in Virgo, my moon's in Virgo, the moon's in Virgo right now. We might, you know, honor that again, the hermetic power of language that we love. And your moon is at 22 plus Virgo, which I know really, really well, because that is the degree of the U.S. Neptune when this country was born. So we go Neptune,
wow.
Neptune, all over the place. It is the soul of this country. And when I first heard Barack Obama in 2004 going, whoa, who's this guy, did his chart, and his Mars is 22 Virgo. So to understand the multiple levels in which people are befoibled and whatever, but also playing a mythic role. So his job, part of it, was to animate the desirable vision of his country, which is how he, you know, swooshed onto the main stage, because he did that. And your moon is just, you know, is again to nourish and feed in the many, many projects that you do, you know, the desirable vision of this country. And but no, you're my favorite thing in the world. We just want to lighten you up a little bit because there's no air in your chart. More laughter, more fun for you. Mercury, your Mercury does sextile creative angle to Venus. So in Taurus, sensual. You are my favorite thing in the world because that is to be a pragmatic mystic. And I think what we all hold different truths, but part of the beauty of your chart that's so coming alive now, and we'll tease it into everything, but is, you know, if we know this, then what do we do? And your Venus, very happy in Taurus. Again, you know, how do we take all teachings, all philosophy, all studies, all spiritual practices so that they make life better for the chimps and the water and the animals and the critters? You know, it's applied divination and applied knowledge. You know, And I like some wag a while ago said, we don't want the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, we want the D.H. Lawrence Laboratory. You know, because so much science is, I just remember this thing that summed it up. It was, I'm going to forget the scientific name, but they were studying the nervous system and how it works, and the little tree parts of our nervous system. And they said, well, we take these sea slugs, and then we shock them. And then we ring a bell, and soon all we have to do is ring a bell and they go into trauma. Isn't that great? I'm like, why not give them chocolate and an orgasm? You know, why pain? Why pain? And I think, you know, part of, you know, against all odds is we're here to transform, you know, a war, sociopathic, uninitiated Mars, dingbat, murderous culture. Trump is so perfect to embody that cartoon, you know, into one of ingenious, applied, compassionate response. You know, so here's you, splendid. And that is also, you know, the aspiration of all crucial gatherings now, one of which is the upcoming Bioneers, which will be not this weekend, but the next weekend. So it is, you know, a gathering of what I've always loved about Bioneers, and I guess I've cahooted with them, I can't remember, decades. But it is, there is conferring, you know, there are fantastic presenters, but it's also where one meets the team, and it is applied, people coming back and reporting on actual goodness that they are doing, right?
It is, and you know, I think the compassionate response is such an eloquent way of describing what I think most attracted me to Bioneers, and in some ways, the way you've described, I think compassionate response was also really well captures my parents' ethos when it comes to working with the chimps. And one of the things that my dad will talk about a little bit, and I will, or at least now you've reminded me, I will try to elicit from him, is that when he was midway through his career or so, he as an experimental psychologist, he was taught and told that you're not supposed to love that with which you work. And how can you get good information? He said, you know, when you're working with incarcerated species of any type, you already are working with a species that is emotionally depressed. We would never compare the data that we gathered from imprisoned humans with the data that we would gather about non-imprisoned humans, because we know empirically that our psychological well-being, or the psychological well-being of human primates, decreases when they are imprisoned, and so you would not consider that to be sound data. So that's just a little free association on the earlier topic. But what's so exciting, I think, about Bioneers, and why I really felt that there was almost a karmic calling to join Bioneers, and certainly maybe even an astrological one, looking at my chart the way you've just described it, is that it is so based on this compassionate approach to the planet and to people, and with solutions and actionable solutions at the core of so many of the ideas that get put forth. So one of the things that I think Kenny Alcibel, the co-founder of Bioneers, along with his wife Nina Simons, talks about is that so many of the answers that we seek in society are already extant in nature.
Yes.
We just have to look for them instead of through our our post-Cartesian European hubris of saying, of imagining that because I think, therefore I can reinvent nature, I somehow have the capacity to do it better than nature. And so I'm really, really excited to be a part of this community of thousands of people who share in this interest in really trying to listen to nature first. And gosh, the way you framed it, it really makes me feel like I was kind of born into this role in some ways. And so it's such an honor.
Yeah, ongoing. You know, I often quote and quoted to you backstage, you know, this wonderful Sir Herbert Reed, who said, only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with technology. And, you know, that all of our metaphors, they derive from nature rather than we use machine metaphors for living things. It's the one, in, you know, kind of encouraging Moon and Virgo editing critique I would have of Buckminster Fuller going, thank you so much. But rather than spaceship Earth, why don't we go the other way around, you know, again, a living model. But, prison, I just want to go back to incarcerated species for a moment. You know, and equality, you know, and teasing equality and manners, into every fiber of our being. You know, Venus conjoining the moon right now says no project really is going to work in this realm, of putting big dreams out into the world without manners and ally etiquette. And, you know, Uranus trickster, you know, again, is nature's evolutionary ingenuity, but the last ideas associated with it are democracy, equality, synchronicity. You know, and wondering for years, you know, what that meant, I realized that we all have different roles, but when we treat each other as equals, which is not necessarily nice, but it is equal, the rate of synchronicity increases dramatically. And, you know, coined the term many eons ago of democratic animism. So it's like, well, why don't we learn the animals' language, for goodness sake? And again, the reversal that wants to happen. And also when you said, you know, imprisoned animals, intimacy, the restoration of intimacy to the world, I found it so poignant that scientists were studying mice songs, and slowing it down so they could hear them, and they go, oh, each mouse, even in prison, composes its unique love song, its courtship song, to another mouse maybe several cages away going, even though I'm in prison, I love you, and here's my ballad. And we go, oh, art, we just want to... So I know you will be exploring all this with Roger and Debbie Fouts, which is important and wonderful to kind of hand the baton, like, here's the research, here's what we learned, where would we like to go, or what would we like to declare? Collaborative research, really. I mean, it's a ways, but the transformation of science so that it really was, you know, informed, reverent curiosity going, hello, chimps, what's your... Well, Jane Goodall learned their language, right?
I mean, I don't know that Jane would... I think even Jane would say that she didn't, quote-unquote, learn their language because we don't actually know what they're thinking. But one of the watchwords that both she and it should be noted, my parents really kind of inherited this project from a husband and wife team named Alan and Beatrix Gardner, who launched what was called the Washoe Project. Washoe was the first non-human primate, the chimp with whom my parents spent 40 years working in their lives. And the notion that they say was to take a critter on its own terms. That's one of my dad's phrases. He uses critter, which I think is one of his regional colloquialisms, but to take a critter on its own terms and basically ask other what they can teach us and ask other how they can inform our understanding. And so with chimps, we have no idea what the complexity and nuances of their nonverbal communications are in the wild. But certainly we know that it's much more complex than we're capable of fully understanding, but they haven't taken the time to cross-foster one of us.
Well,
and teach us how to...
Yeah, so far. But also, did you see Jane Goodall on the Colbert Report when Colbert was doing that thing? She said to him, shall we greet each other as chimps? And he's like, oh, sure. And then he goes, yeah. And he goes, no, you don't do that because you like me. Here's what we do. I look down and you go, anyway, I mean, she taught him a little bit of chimp, in their greeting. But yes, and, you know, and the link between fairy tales and science, you know, everything that's been dissed, you know, Neptune and its radical realm is what has been banished from respectable intellectual cultural discourse, you know, all that has been undervalued that is of enormous value, and the many mysterious ways we might begin to explore, even with the, you know, the likes of yourself and your parents too, of, you know, of going as learners rather than as tormentors and prisoners. Anyway, so well, there is that, and I guess you're going to be going into that with Roger and Debbie Fouts, yeah?
I will, and in fact, if there are any questions that you or your audience have for them, I'd be happy to seed those. But one of the things that you just reminded me of when you were talking about the songs of mice is a speaker who was at Bioneers last year, and I think this, for your listeners who haven't been to Bioneers before, I'm sure they're a very, very, very limited number, because I think I see us as sibling species as well, the Bioneers community and the Coyote News Network community. But Monica Galliano, who is an Italian researcher based in Australia, spoke last year, and she's been looking at the language of plants, and she discovered that plant seeds actually vibrate at a frequency that is audible to the human ear. We just haven't learned to listen to it. Again, it's about listening to nature, you know, that's so interesting. And one of the things she talked about is that you can put a chili seed in the midst of corn seeds, and or say at a certain distance, and the corn seeds, once they sprout, will all intuitively grow in the opposite direction, even though the chili seed hadn't sprouted. Like, they hear each other.
And well, we didn't, you mean the opposite direction to the chili seed, going, that's
thank
chili.
You. Exactly. They know, and I guess we presume that they are able to hear the frequency of the chili seed and grow in the opposite direction away from it, because it's not a friendly seed for the corn seeds, for example.
Right. Yes, that's great. And then music seems an interesting realm. Here comes Neptune into knowledge of collaboration. Our great friend of show and spirit brother David Grimes speaks about when he was with Rick Steiner, who's a wolf expert in Alaska. They were out camping, and as they were playing guitars, an entire wolf pack came and joined them for their breakfast and sat around the fire and jammed with them.
Incredible.
And he said even the little baby wolf was like, rrr. And then one look from the leader after a kind of good 30-minute jam, and, you know, the leader looked at everybody, and then they quietly withdrew, but they jammed. I know from, you know, my, yeah, all, you know, animals we keep, you know, I've lived with Stella Coyote, a half coyote dog, for 18 years. If she'd been a full coyote, I would have given her one-way ticket to Denver. But between worlds beings, so learned a lot there. But Stella thinks that, you know, humans, forget them. But music, not heavy metal, but lovely music, stringed instruments, she likes that, and pillows. She thinks those are really the sum of what humans have to contribute to the world, and you can keep the rest. But the musical realm, and we know whales like humans singing, the chorusing, and then just if we go back to all the essential mythologies of now, that are at the core of, you know, many civilizations, and the Grail legend, it begins with the white stag galloping into Arthur's court. And Arthur says, nature has sent an emissary, and we must change our ways. And everyone go forth into the woods where it is darkest for you, and do not come back until you've had a conversation with nature. You know, and that's how the whole thing starts, right? I mean, so we go, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but I feel it to be true that, you know, when we are alone in nature now, those, you know, lucky enough with the opportunity to go trekking out there, there are animal emissaries. They're, you know, it's like, you go talk to the humans. No, you go. I'd never seen a bobcat before until, you know, downtown Denver once. I'm like, wow, who are, what? Oh, and they're like, my people sent me. And I will say, you know, some of us are trying to be less rude, and they're like, speed it up, will you? So there is that realm. But you grew up with these chimps, right?
They didn't live in our house, but they were at my dad's place of work. And during the first decade of the project, or when we lived in Oklahoma, they actually lived on a sort of a farm a compound known as the farm, where there was an island, and they actually had to flee that area because many of the chimps, after Reagan was elected, and Ronald Reagan, when he was elected in 1979, one of the first acts that he did was to remove remove all federal funding for behavioral research. So it all went to biomedical research, which suddenly made chimps a really hot target for biomedical vivisection, those kinds of things. And the community in which the chimps with whom my dad was working, note that the rhetorical narrative is to never describe these chimps as quote unquote his chimps, but the chimps with whom he was collaborating, because he never ever actually wanted to assume ownership of them, more stewardship of their well-being in collaboration with them. But the chimps with whom those chimps were living started to disappear because they were being sold to biomedical labs. So we used to periodically visit the community where those chimps lived, and I, not having Mars and Aries as my dad does, having Mars and Scorpio was not didn't have as quick of a reflex to engage non-human primates in the way that they like to be engaged. And there's a definite whole story in that I think will be fun to elicit out at Friday at their panel.
You mean erotically? I mean, what does it mean?
No, I mean chimps have a much faster nonverbal response to any kind of surprise. So there, and I think perhaps this is one reason I wouldn't know the origins of this, but their vocalizations are entirely limbically controlled, which is to say, as you know, if I were to drop something on your foot right now, you wouldn't look down and say, oh my, that hurt my foot. You would yell, ow, that hurts. That's a limbic response. Well, chimps' entire vocal vocabulary is controlled limbically. So when they see food, they erupt with a food bark. Or when they see someone they like, as you saw Jane Goodall do on the Colbert Report, they'll do a pant hoot. And so there's a whole series of these involuntary responses that are expressed through their vocalizations that are highly adaptive in the wild, because it means that they have trigger responses that are much faster than humans. So that's a whole other interesting evolutionary tactic, I think, that makes them. I spent 2 weeks with my family at Gombe Bay Reserve, where Jane Goodall has done most of her work, and I discovered in those 2 weeks that I would make a horrible, horrible chimp, because I, as a bipedal, primarily upright human being, I'm not well adapted to ducking down quickly and going under the bush, or ascending trees rapidly and hunting groups of monkeys. So we are entirely adapted for a different lifestyle of work, and it's one of those things that as you start to pick out what is through the hubris of humans, we like to talk about how we are so much better at such and such a things, but we're so much worse at so many other things because of that. So anyway, I've digressed from where the chimps live to biomedical labs to limbic vocalizations, but we didn't actually live with the chimps at home.
Right. No, it's all important. I mean, it is your assignment in a way. Crossing species borders, crossing false and true cultural borders, is part of all of our assignment. But to go backwards just a smidge, when your father said this important thing to put on our work table, that science has said you can't go native, you can't love what you're studying. And I think the return of Venus, the restoration of intimacy to the world, and Neptune water reflects a reverse image going, let's reverse this. You can only learn from what you love. Whatever you love loves you, and you form an interesting, collaborative partnership. And part of, I think, what's going on now is the cataclysm. After the beginning of the Gulf ecocide, the BP spill, went to a really great TEDx conference on the Gulf, and it was the world's leading water scientists, and they were all weeping. Right, so it's like a living tarot card. The hard-nosed scientists who were just supposed to be just sex, just studying, but they were weeping. They were Neptuning because they knew how horrible this was, and they knew what a betrayal this was. I mean, they were speaking of dolphins trying to get out of the water onto their boats, and so they were all weeping, and I think that's an important. I also love, and I keep talking about, and we'll keep talking about, this Saturn square Neptune of the rewedding of compassion and mythology with scientific knowledge inquiry, and how we define intellect in an ever more expansive and all-inclusive way. So I love the Pluto New Horizons rocket project in a million ways. One, have you seen the photos coming back from Pluto?
I have. In fact, the one where Pluto, the Disney the Disney cartoon dog is actually in Ambassador Leaf Against the Heart.
Oh, I don't know that one, but I have seen the heart. Yeah. But part of why I love this as a Saturn, you know, again, engineering, research, techno mind with mythology and compassion, part of our dynamic that is part of human necessary evolution now, that the critters and the folk are waiting for us to catch up, is first, the project took 9.5 years from launch to arrive at Pluto, and that's very witty because there's 9 steps to the underworld. Mm-hmm. I love that there were more women working on this project, and I want to come back to your work on leadership and chimps and women. Okay, put a little star somewhere on a piece of paper there to come back to that. And also, they certainly spoke about Pluto as a planet. It's a planet. Buzz off, you Neil deGrasse Tyson guy. But they also spoke of the rocket with enormous affection, this little being. And they put on this rocket two really interesting things. They put some of Clyde Tombaugh's ashes on the rocket, he who discovered Pluto. So human ashes have left the solar system. But for me, even cooler, they put a quarter, a 25-cent piece on the rocket to pay Charon, the ferryman. Charon is Pluto's moon. And when people die in many cultures, people put a coin on their lips to pay Charon, the underworld ferryman. So the scientists beforehand said this incredible engineering feat of the little rocket, you know, wending its way betwixt, you know, Charon, this large moon, and Pluto, and they were going to lose touch with it. And they said, this little rocket, it's going to be the loneliest robot in the world, but we put a quarter on to pay Charon for safe passage. And then when the little rocket emerged, they were like, it worked. So anyway, the wedding of mystery, you know, knowledge and mystery, Saturn and Neptune, wonder, and, you know, may it be a whole unfolding, you know, at pioneers, at everywhere, you know, of reverent science. You know, science as though everything was alive as opposed to everything. And also, human hegemony. I want to throw, you know, humanism into Pluto's cauldron, humans as the measure of all things, and replace it, you know, the hubris of humanism, and replace it with the truth of animism. Everything's alive. As the NASA scientists were, you know, playfully kind of admitting to them, the little rocket was alive. It was. And they love it. And I think that wants to come into play. You know, and so it's a whole realm of knowledge with imagination and mythology and wonder, right? I mean, do you think of it as may it be from upcoming conference and, I mean, everything that humble science emerge of so much of biomimicry, you know, is collaborate with the ingenuity of nature humbly?
I think so. You know, last year we had a green chemist by the name of John Warner, who
yes.
was another one of these scientists who had this epiphanic moment. And I love the I'm sitting in San Francisco right now and being raised by the Blue Angel Jets and like the clash, listening to that while my phone was on mute and listening to your description of technology. I thought the synchronistic irony of that was well worth paying attention to. But John Warner had sort of a crisis of ethics as well when his son died from an environmentally caused illness, and he basically said, why has chemistry been attempting to reinvent nature when again we should be listening to nature, and that coming back to that reverent that reverence toward nature and a more reverent approach to science, I think is beautiful. And I'm reminded of a quote that has become sort of a mantra of pioneers that is often heard through the words of Joanna Macy, and it's called, it's all alive, it's all connected, and it's all intelligent, it's all relatives. And I just think more and more as those words quicken, if you will, we begin to see how it's all connected and the universe is in conversation with us, and the beautiful symmetry of what you've just described about the little rocket with its 25-cent piece flying off to, you know, it was just, I love it.
It's very darling, and we've been having such a good romp that I blew past our little tiny midpoint station break. We're gonna have a very short break now. Thank you, Berkeley, for being patient, and we'll be right back with our wonderful guest Joshua Fouts, Executive Director of Bioneers Conference, and much more on our work table. Here we go. Or not.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. Jenny, Jenny, come blow my Jenny home. Ooh, Jenny, 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 come blow my Jenny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our perfect and splendid guest is Joshua Fouts. He is the executive director of Bioneers. We are speaking of chimps, and I want to get to and women's leadership from chimps, and also virtual reality. I want to touch into your, and we'll weave it all together somehow to the Second Life and the interesting part and the shadow part, because it is kind of related. Maybe I'm jumping over there in our free form. Yes, let me join your Mercury and Pisces. Because I was so intrigued, and this is kind of the Neptunian realm and the art of cultural influence and shadow. Clients of mine had said that they were deeply involved in this thing called Second Life, and I was like, oh. Okay. And there's a whole commerce and a whole civilization that goes on, and I haven't explored it yet, but I was talking to an 89-year-old friend of mine who is a Jungian analyst and wonderfully kick-butt and splendid, and she's like, I'm game. Sign me up. I'm gonna open my Jungian analysis dream practice in Second Life, and I go, I'll get back to you. So swirling around, we're gonna aspire to bring this back to chimps and women, you know, but can you lay out a little bit of what you were laying out for me backstage about Second Life and people's avatars actually, affecting in a positive way their physical, reality bodies.
Sure. So I like to say that my parents are into interspecies communication, and I'm into intraspecies communication. And I'm also I like to take a page from a lot of the lessons I learned from them, one of which is to take a culture or a critter on its own terms. And in 2005, I had sort of an epiphanic moment where I'd been introduced to 3D video games, and I noticed that what was going on, and this was, we were still in the fallout, if you will, of September 11th. Nerves were still very, very raw following the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and the U.S. had basically spoiled all the goodwill that came out of September 11th when we chose to invade Iraq, and so most of Europe and most of the planet really thought Americans were idiots. And what I noticed is that these 3D virtual spaces, video games, for example, if people didn't know who each other were, they were having shared experiences of informal experiences of play. That play ended up building and facilitating relationships that helped them see the other person behind their 3D avatar, if you will. I don't know how many people in the audience have seen the movie, but by now, Avatar by James Cameron, but
it was 3.5/5 a good movie. All right, now back to you.
Exactly, but the gist of it was that people were entering into a computer animated version of themselves, and so if you take that metaphor and you apply it to what we see on computer screens these days, there was a project I was involved in from 2008 until roughly 2010, looking at how virtual worlds were considered to be different from video games in that they were non-prescriptive. There were no actual rules that are applied to them. People go into these 3D digital virtual world spaces and just kind of create new realities. But one of the things that's been interesting what goes on in virtual worlds is that when we create an avatar of ourselves or a digital representation of ourselves, our brains already project that as being an extension of ourselves. It's called something, it's a phenomena called co-presence. And there's a Stanford University professor who studied for several years that even the people who create avatars for themselves in virtual worlds, such as this platform that you've just described called Second Life, which actually still exists and is still, I guess, a profitable business where people are engaging in commerce in digital goods, which is a whole other conversation. But just a couple seconds, literally a half a minute spent looking at your own digital version of yourself, your own avatar, is enough to cause a substantive enough behavioral changes that people are transformed by that experience. So one example is people who are overweight, who create avatars of that are skinnier than they, become or take efforts to emulate and or lose weight similar to reflect their more, say, authentic digital version of themselves. And so part of that is because we're wired for 3D. We as upright bipedal primates have stereoscopic vision, and so we see everything in 3D. So when we see a 3D version of ourselves on a screen, for example, our brain in many ways remembers that as real. And I actually gave a speech about this in 2011 at Bioneers. It was the second time that I appeared at Bioneers, and it was a plenary keynote speech, and people can Google that and learn a little bit about it. But the phenomena of working in digital spaces was something that was very appealing to me because I found that humans had the thing that really that most appealed to me is that I was struck by the inability that humans had to reconnect following September 11th and the dissonance and the misunderstandings that occurred between Muslim and non-Muslim cultures, between U.S. and non-U.S. cultures, and I wanted to find a way to mediate that. And these 3D virtual spaces seemed like an environment in which there was no possibility for physical violence because we were only connected over computer screens, and because it felt to our brains as real in some ways, our brains remembered these experiences as real, it had an opportunity to actually change behaviors. And the several projects that I did ended up getting the attention of both the Bush and the Obama White Houses, and it was a great round. But it's kind of a moment that's passed. Virtual worlds are no longer sort of on the front page of the technological scene because of just the sheer growth of Facebook. But it's still a phenomena that exists, and it's still an interesting platform to explore. And it's interesting also for me to hear that you have friends and clients and collaborators who still are interested in exploring it, because I think that
Well, they were having a very happy time. I mean, and I do want to kind of aspire to weave it all together here. Medical researchers did a lot of work with mirrors and people who had strokes, and say the left side of your body is paralyzed. In the mirror, you're seeing it move. Because it's a reverse image, right? So they found that people working with mirrors every day, they recovered, the paralyzed part of their body recovered at some huge percentage of increase, meaning if the mind can see it, even if we're guiding it into a useful illusion, it will create the neurological pathway to make it happen. So now we get to the Second Life and the idea of looking at an avatar going, will I really grow coyote ears? Oh, I hope so. There's that. So if we see it, the brain is a mimicker. And then I want to just put one other thing here on our mystery rambunctious council table. There was, I'm always looking for these quirky things, right? So scientists studying captive, unfortunately, dolphins in England noticed that when they were sleeping, they began to speak whale. And I go, oh, how interesting. And the dolphins were speaking whale language. And I read this, report, and I was like, how interesting. And I had a wonderful late great Wolfie dog that really raised Stella Coyote. And that night, Stella Coyote, in her sleep, began to speak wolf. She did this long, because coyotes and wolves, very, very different sound, right? And she did this long, just like our friend Moondog, and I go, ooh, in these dream worlds, this is so full of mystery. Animals are speaking other language, other species language, in their sleep. And I just go, oh, interesting mystery, over to one side again. The crossing. And I do just want to bring up, part of your dedication, again, to weave compassion and pragmatic mysticism into making a world more beautiful. You know, hence again your work as executive director of Bioneers and the many panels that you'll be on and the work with your parents and all of that. You know, again, that we're looking into a reversal, approaching things with mystery, you know, liberating mystery rather than imprisoning certainty. Going, oh, we wonder, what is these mysteries? And let me toss to you, and maybe you can ask your parents, what is unique to our species aside from our rudeness? And I want to kind of prime the pump, maybe that you can pass it to your parents, going, I posit that perhaps one of our opportunities and responsibilities is our capacity to borrow qualities of intelligence from the flora and fauna on this planet. Is that something you wonder about?
I do wonder about, and one of the things that I look at this also through the reverse filter is that I think that we tend to, as humans, treat non-humans, there's a certain thing that goes on with the double-edged sword of that I've noticed in terms of our relationship with non-human primates. And one of my dad's arguments is that be careful about how close you are genetically to white European males, for you will suffer the most. And I'll see if I can get him to tell the story about how if you look at that. For many years, for hundreds, for thousands of years, it was women and non-white males who suffered the most under the aegis of white European males. And then slowly he says that he has a story where he talks about we need to break down the Cartesian castle. There's a Cartesian castle, if you will, and the drawbridge is let down, and first non-white males are brought in. Because in the U.S. Society, African American males had the right to vote before women, so of any color. So women have always been suppressed over males across all racial ties. And then what's starting to go on in the chimp world is that we've decided that the bonobo species of chimps are kinder than the pan troglodytes, which is another species of chimps. That's the species with whom Jane Goodall primarily works in East Africa. And we project a more softer, kinder, loving mythos on them, which is absolutely not the case. For any of them.
Can you disabuse us of that desirable fantasy?
Well, sure. So the bonobos who are in captivity are not so docile that they don't bite people's humans' fingers off. And this isn't to say that all chimps are biting people's fingers off, but any incarcerated primate doesn't like to be incarcerated.
Right.
And it will do things to try to mitigate that circumstance. And you see it through slavery as well. And slavery ends up, how long did white humans suppress non-white humans until revolt came about? You know, we've been doing it. Slavery exists across all species. So bonobos in particular, there is violence. There's a great book by Richard Wrangham, who's a protege of Jane Goodall's, called, I just lost it. It's a it'll come back to me anyway. But it works to disabuse us of the fact that, that there are species that are more, say, docile and graceful than humans.
Well, yes.
Demonic males.
Sure, any animal incarcerated, you know, good on them, you know, going, I bite you with my, let me out, you dingbat. The gray whales in San Ignacio Lagoon were very violent because they were protecting their youth and their babies. And then they, once humans stopped that horrible behavior, the gray whales began to make intimate connection with humans, and the scientists, even hard-nosed scientists, here's the scientists weeping again, a very good sign, saying, I think they're forgiving us. But are bonobos violent? You know, and we don't want to sentimentalize, you know, which is a toxic thing. We don't want to anthropomorphize, and it is dodgy. And we don't want to do. I once liberated a group of people from, tyrannical German tantricas who were like, you must have mandatory dolphin tantra now. I'm like, no, you don't. Run for the hills. Anyway, so no, all that spiritual colonialism stuff. But are bonobos more violent than humans would like to imagine? In their own, when they're not being messed with?
That I can't speak to, but I can give you an example of this is another story that I'll try and elicit from my father. So those in your listening audience who aren't able to make it to the panel, we'll see if he doesn't tell the story, you get to hear it here first and only here. And it's one of the things that gets me so excited about being part of the Bioneers community is that it offers us the huge amounts of material to feed our, if you will, our moral imaginations. And so here's the story. So there was a time period where we lived in Washington State, a rural part of Washington State, and the chimps, all of whom had been raised as deaf human children, were accustomed to having basically a middle class U.S. lifestyle. They knew fast food, they knew ice cream, they knew how to tell what kind of ice cream that they want. So my dad was taking one of the chimps' tattoo out as a special treat to Dairy Queen to get one of her favorite ice cream. And Tattoo was in the passenger seat of our Honda Accord, and this is around 1981, so it was before the time where there were hand-rolled windows. And Tattoo had the window about halfway down, and they were in the drive-through lane. And a woman in a pickup truck in this rural town stops the truck in the middle of the street and jumps out of her truck and comes running over toward our car, yelling, "It's a monkey, it's a monkey." Now pause for a second, Carol, and imagine yourself sitting in your car with the window rolled down while you're waiting in line at your bank, while you're trying to fix whatever might be mixed up in Mercury retrograde with your bank account.
Yes,
and a man three times your size comes running down the street, "It's an astrologer, it's an astrologer," and attempts, you would do whatever you could to try to protect yourself. Probably you'd roll up your window, maybe you would have a can of pepper spray, I don't know. But in Tatu's case, all that she had was my dad frantically trying to roll the window up. He gets the window almost up while the woman gets her fingers into the window.
Oh.
He kind of pinches her fingers in. She pulls them out, curses at my dad. He rolls the window up. And the moral of his story is, he says, what would have happened had the woman got her hands and touched the Tatu, this chimp? Well, Tatu probably would have done something to defend herself. And since chimps are 8 times the strength of a human pound for pound, they can crack Brazil nuts with their fingers.
Wow.
She probably would have bitten a finger off. And who would have been at fault if that woman's finger had been bitten off?
That woman
wouldn't have been. Right, exactly.
Well, because I have, you know, yes. Well, now we're back to manners. Right, you know,
we're back to manners. Moon and Virgo, woo!
We're back to manners is a crucial thing of how we collaborate, how we gather, you know, how we pioneer, how we do anything is our manner of relating and offering. La 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 serves Renaissance, or an imposition serves colonialism and empire, no matter what we say. You know, and again, yes, reverent respect. Yeah, because I've had, you know, dodgy complex animals, and when people rush up, I go, no, do not rush up, and teach your children to not put their face in any dog's face
exactly.
Without meeting. I mean, it's just manners. And the thing I forgot several miles back, is that I keep with me always, is in the early days of the show, hosted a Lakota elder on, we were talking about coyotes and everything, and he said, you know, we Lakota did not hunt alone. Every fall, every necessary time, like now, and maybe that's kind of part of what Bioneers and Open Secret and everything is doing, he said those gifted would go into a trance, and they would broker a treaty with the wolves and coyotes, and we would all hunt together for a season. And if you want to destroy a culture, destroy its capacity for collaborative, reciprocal, mutual aid across species borders, and if you destroy that, you can walk all over it. And I keep that everywhere, you know, as a part of us that lives in our mythological DNA, that remembers this, that, you know, remembers emerging from a difficult negotiation going, all right, it wasn't easy. You know, the coyotes want the front left leg and half the liver of every other deer, and the wolves are cool with that, and the deer are cool with that. All right, everybody back on stage. And I find this a really infinitely useful, well, resonant. Okay, it resonates with me, you know, going, right, and I'm always... You know, I know from, you know, coyote beings, well, all critters, really. It's a telepathic, sometimes, negotiation of respect. If I do this, if you give up this, I give up this, and we have that. That, you know, and certainly with coyotes and coyotes in the wild, and what I've learned from living with a half two minds being, you know, is coyotes, unlike dogs, no shame, but complete negotiation. You know, okay, coyote, you know, even on a telepathic level, I'm just putting it out there because I, you know, if you go, no, you may not eat the cat, But if you do not eat the cat and the chickens, I will leave fun things a mile over there for you. And they're like, oh, well, okay. You know? It's again, experimental whimsy. You know, because right now, you know, part of our dynamic is, you know, Uranus is nature's evolutionary experimental ingenuity, which doesn't have a category about success-fail. It's like, try that, try that. Try that thing. Nope. Try that thing. Nope. Ooh, that was really... So, and I think right now, you know, nature's sending an emissary to the humans as though nature's saying, we got to either kill the humans or heal them. We'll try healing them first, you know. But Paul Stamets, you know, our great buddy, you know, is talking about, you know, viral storms when a species has exceeded its manners. You know, viral storms are unleashed to, you know, eliminate the abusive species, which, you know, could well be us. But the problem with that, even with that, is, you know, humans going down or taking so much life with it. So it's better to have manners. And I think experimenting with all parts of human capacity in a humble way, because we get our word human from humus, the dirt, right? So the antidote to hubris is humus, dirt, from which we get the word humble. We're meant to be humble in the dirt, people. But yes, in our waning moments, so much. Let's keep talking forever, Joshua. But you did want to say something about what you learned about women's leadership from chimpanzees.
I didn't. I was saying that my dad has told me that he's working on a new book about what Washoe, who was the matriarch of these of the chimp family, who was part of our family, what she taught him about women's leadership. And that's one of the core tenets of Bioneers. Bioneers co-founder Nina Simons has been a staunch advocate of trying to change the narrative, change the rhetoric, and change the dynamic that in which women have been culturally suppressed over millennia in the human species. And how is it that we can facilitate women's leadership? And my dad is arguing that he's learned some things about women's leadership from working for 40 years with a female chimpanzee who he considers more of his big sister than a different species. And in fact, one of the rhetorical flourishes that my parents used was to really look at the chimps with whom my dad and mom worked as our aunts and uncles, more than.
We'll have to come to your event at Bioneers or have you on the radio again to find out what some nugget of women's leadership from Washoe would be. And right. I do prefer the astrological language of Venus and Mars even to men and women. Venusian leadership, you know, women's. I love my friend saying, what if the idea of matriarchy is a patriarchal concept as opposed to actual equality? But we'll come back on all of these exciting things. So, Joshua Fouts, thank you so much. Executive Director of Bioneers. We will be convening again next weekend. Friday the 16th through the 18th, there we go, bioneers.org. I will also be giving a talk on the 15th at Open Secret, that's it. And then also at Bioneers on the 16th, Friday night, you can come to the Just That or sign up for the whole thing. There we go. More on my website, coyotenetworknews.com. Thanks so much, Eileen in Washington, D.C., Erica Bridgman in Berkeley, and thank you again, Joshua Fouts. I'll see you very soon.
See you next Friday here in San Francisco. Can't wait.
Woof, woof. All right. Oh.
The black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years. Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one.
For news, information, and analysis about Africa and the African diaspora, tune in weekly on Mondays at 7 p.m. to Africa Today with your host, Walter Turner. Africa Today is your source for being up to date on Africa and Africans. Mondays at 7 p.m. Africa Today on your Pacifica radio station, KPFA 94.1 FM.
Here's another community-powered announcement from KPFA.
Chesanami Foundation invites you to Taste of Africa, the fourth annual extravaganza and adventure into African culture on October 11th. This magical afternoon of cultural exploration and celebration of diversity will take place at the Banquet Theater on 2400 First Street, downtown Livermore. This event consists of free day-long activities at the Share Homes Plaza starting at 10 a.m. and a main ticketed event at the Banquet Theater starting at 3 p.m. Proceeds benefit Chesanami's youth diversity programs in the Bay Area. For more information, call 925-398-3827 or visit www.chesanami.org.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3.